Today we discuss the idea of civilization. And first I want to present to you the general understanding of how we get civilization. And then I will present to you an alternative. Okay? So the traditional understanding is the Marxist understanding. This is the idea proposed by Karl Marx, and it's the dominant idea. So, in the beginning, we were hunter-gatherers. And it sucked to be a hunter-gatherer because you could not find food. And then, we discovered agriculture, farming. And that allowed for surplus food. Surplus just means that you have more food than you can eat. And so now you have people who don't have to work, okay, an elite. And as such, they can engage in activities that improve the well-being of everyone and which create the basis for civilization. These things include religion, okay, which are just myths and stories, but also arts. Dance, music, songs, paintings. And then, of course, you have science and technology. And with these three things in place, now you can grow as a society. Okay, you can now build cities. Why? Because now you can have irrigation and farming. Okay? You can now direct the river flow so you can use more farmland. Okay, you can now have a hereditary elite. And so that these people can focus their entire time on innovation, on science, on progress. Okay? And then you have writing. Because only a hereditary elite has the time and the resources to learn how to write. Because remember, back then, writing is a very difficult activity. You have to spend your entire life learning it and practicing it. And then you have the idea of money and property. Okay? And together, these four things are what we refer to as civilization. Now, there are good things that come from civilization, religion, arts, and science, but there are also bad things as well, which include war, slavery, and debt. Okay? And that is the story of civilization that you're taught in school, and that most mainstream academics understand. Today, I want to propose an alternative, and I think this is a much more compelling alternative than this one. And the idea is this. From the very beginning, we were religious, artistic, and capable of science. Okay? We did not need an elite to do this for us. We are all capable of doing this by ourselves. And the examples, of course, are the cave paintings that we discuss, as well as these religious settlements, Göbekli Tepe, Karahoyak. Okay? And as we discussed before, people come together to practice their religion, building temples, building monuments. And then slowly, around these temples, you have development of farming, in order to sustain these temples, in order to practice the religion. But over time, what happens is that the temple people become corrupt. Rather than being elected by the people, rather than serve the people, they become hereditary, okay? They engage in rent-seeking. And so, what people do is, they just leave and build a temple somewhere else. And throughout this time, all these temples are being built. But in certain locations, the temples can also engage in trade. Why? Because they're the meeting place of many, many other communities. And as such, their real estate is the most valuable in the world. And so it's hard for people to leave, and the place just grows and grows and grows. And as this civilization grows, the people in charge create something called a temple economy. Okay? And this is just a primitive form of taxation. Basically, what happens is that everyone brings food to the temple, and the priests then redistribute the food amongst everyone else. Okay? And that allows for public works projects, like irrigation, mainly irrigation, but also more temples. Okay? And because of this economy, now you need writing. You need to record how much food you have. You have to record who gets what food, the rations. You also need to record trade, right? How much grain you're getting from here, how much cows you're giving to over there, okay? Now you have a running system, then you have money. But as this civilization develops, a strict hierarchy emerges. And the hierarchy goes against the natural order. Also remember that people at any time can just choose to leave. So how do you make people stay where they are and just follow the natural order? Well, now you have to create mythology. Okay? Which then you encode or write down. So that seems as though it's coming from the gods themselves. Okay, does that make sense? In other words, civilization did not give us religion, arts, and science. We already had these things. We could at any time in our history do all these things. Civilization is a device meant to gaslight or fool people into believing that a hierarchy is legitimate when it is not legitimate. It is meant to fool people into thinking of that this hierarchical system is divinely ordained. Okay? So that's the argument I will make to you today. Before I continue, are you clear about this framework? This is a traditional framework. This is what you've been taught in school. The problem with this framework is that it assumes that we're all stupid. And if we're all stupid, it's hard to explain how we did the cave paintings, how we built Kebelo Tepe, okay? How we did Kalahoya. It assumes all these things. This new understanding is that we're all capable of creativity, but eventually, because of social development, we have these large cities, and now the people in charge need to create civilization in order to justify the hierarchy. Okay? All right. So having said that, let's look at the four earliest major civilizations in our history. And they are, of course, Egypt, Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iraq, the Indus Valley Civilization. This is also referred to as the Harappan, okay? Harappan Civilization, because their capital is Harappa. And then the last one, of course, is China, right? Now the question then is, why is that these four are the early civilizations? And they have three unique characteristics, okay? The first is their latitude. They're actually in the same latitude. They're not too hot and they're not too cold, which makes them perfect for agriculture. Okay, that's the first characteristic. Second characteristic is that they are by major rivers, right? So Egypt is, of course, by the Nile. Mesopotamia has been called the Tigris and the Euphrates. Indus Valley, of course, has the Indus River. And China has, of course, the Yellow River, okay? That's the second major characteristic. This allows for you to build a fairly large city, okay? Because now you can solve the water and transportation problem, okay? And also agriculture. And the last characteristic, which is the most important, is they're by the sea or they're by the ocean, which allows for them to engage in trade, okay? Transportation, bringing in new goods, new people, and new ideas. So Egypt has the Mediterranean as well as the Red Sea. Mesopotamia goes into the Arabian Sea, which goes into the Indian Ocean. And so the Indus is the same situation, okay? Goes in the Arabian Sea and then the Indian Ocean. China, of course, goes into the Pacific. All right? So what will happen over time is that because of the trade location, they're able to build a very large city, okay, over time. So, but then what will happen is that as larger city becomes larger and larger, they will develop colonies upstream and downstream of the river, okay? So they will build more colonies, and this is how you get civilization. Okay, you always have a major city, and as it becomes too big, you have other places in order to expand your trade reach. Okay, so the priority is trade. And as you can see, what's happening is that these areas are able to connect the entire world, right? So Egypt is able to connect Europe and the Levant and Africa, okay? Mesopotamia is able to connect Anatolia, Asia, Central Asia, and then Indus Valley is able to do the same thing, okay? China is a special case because of the Himalayas. So there is trade actually between China and these other parts, but not as much. And so China is a special case, and we don't discuss China in this class. Okay? So these three places are what we collectively call Western civilization. So you may have thought that Western civilization is just Europe and America. That's not true. Okay, if you just look at the history, these places have always been in contact with each other. And collectively, they built the foundations for Western civilization. Let me ask you this question. Looking at this map, where is the most strategically located place? You guys know? It's here, right? Does that make sense, you guys? This is right in the center of global trade. And guess what? This place is where human civilization began. This place is what we call Sumeria. Sumer, okay? And this is where writing was invented. Okay? And this is where a lot of trade happened. Because if you just look at this map, Sumeria is what connects everyone to everyone else, right? If you're in the Indus Valley civilization and you want to get through Egypt, you have to first transport your goods to Sumeria, which then overland takes it to Egypt. Same thing with Egypt, okay? Same thing if you want to reach everywhere else. Does that make sense? That's why Sumeria was the first major civilization, okay? And they invented writing, as well as irrigation, as well as a lot of technology. And there's been a lot of debate about Sumeria, because one thing that puzzles scholars and historians is the language the Sumerians speak is not the same as the surrounding areas, okay? So that's why a lot of historians believe that the people in Sumeria came from somewhere else. And that may be true. Why? Because this is the major trade route, right? And it's possible that what happened was that different people came together in this area to trade and they formed their own language. That is possible, okay? Also, scholars have been surprised or amazed at the rapid development of Sumeria. And that's why, okay, I don't know why, but there are some people on the internet who believe that aliens came to Sumeria and created humans, okay? These aliens are called the Anunnaki. And it's a really stupid idea. And what you learn in this class is that if you put humans together, and they need to do something, they will do it very well. Okay, does that make sense? Yes. Okay? Necessity is the mother of creativity. It's because they have to come together to trade, to interact, that they create their own writing system. Okay, so if I were to take different people from the world and just dump them on the island, you guys would really quickly be able to develop your own language, your own writing system, your own civilization. Because again, necessity is the mother of invention. All right. So that's the general framework we're working with. Any questions before I can continue? Okay, good. All right. So let's do the PPT. All right. So in this class, I want to talk about how, because of civilization development, they start to promote writing and promote mythology. Okay. And what I will show you is that by studying mythology properly, you can actually decode or uncover or reveal the history of the civilization, even though it may be lost to us. Okay? All right. Let's continue. All right. So one principle that I want you to learn about human history is that it's a constant process of inversion. Okay? And what I mean by that is that as humans progress, or as human society grows and grows, they need to constantly innovate in their system, and they do it through inversion. So during the caveman era, it was an egalitarian society, which was fluid, which was dynamic, and they were animistic, which meant that they believed that everything had God in it, okay? They were all part of God. And then with agriculture, you had the mother god of civilization, because you needed fertility, right? The mother goddess is able to give you more children as well as help you grow crops. But over time, as society became larger and larger, they started to go war with each other, okay? And now the male overtakes the female. Rather than worship the mother goddess, they now worship the sky god. And before, during the mother goddess, it was assumed that the mother goddess serves us because she's kind, she's compassionate. But now the sky god, we have to serve the gods, okay? And then as society becomes more hereditary, what happens often are civil wars where the prince kills the king, okay? The son kills the father in an inversion, okay? The last process is that over time, as society becomes more populated, you need a bureaucracy. What will happen is that the bureaucrats will collude together to steal power from the king. Okay, the servant rules the king. Okay, so this is a major pattern of historical development that I want you guys to remember. Remember that history is a constant process of inversion. Okay, where the old order is being dethroned by the new order. Okay, so that's one idea I want you guys to remember. Okay, all right. So basic framework we're working with is that before we started the mother goddess, where women were in control. And they focus on balance and harmony, okay, and fertility. And their understanding of the mother goddess is that she's kind and she's compassionate. Okay, so you don't really have to work that much. You just have to respect her, and she will provide you with a lot of babies and a lot of good food, okay? Now we go to the sky god. And different societies have different sky gods, but they're basically the same concept. So in Egypt, they have Ra. In Babylonia, they have Marduk. In Greece, they have Zeus. In Rome, they have Jupiter, right? And the sky god demands struggle and toil, okay? To rape, exploit, control the earth, to take the mother goddess and to control her, okay? And you do that by building canals, by building farms. So it's a constant process of exploitation, okay? Not only are you exploiting nature, the mother goddess, but you're also exploiting each other. You go to war, you conquer other people, you enslave them, okay? It's a constant process of sacrifice and discipline. Okay, so this is the major transition. All right, so the four major civilizations we talked about, as you can see from this map, they're the same latitude, right? China's over here, again, because of the Himalayas, they're blocked from the rest of the world, okay? But these three areas, Egypt, Mesopotamia, and the Indus Valley, you can see how close they are to each other and how they can easily access each other through the sea, right? And once they're able to access each other, they can then access other parts of the world as well. So right from the beginning, guys, it's really important, Western society was integrated through trade, through communication. And so the ideas, the people, were always in exchange with each other. Okay, so you cannot understand the development of Egypt in isolation from Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley. Okay, they were all influence each other. Unfortunately, because of Western prejudice, you're often taught that these things are separate from each other. Okay? But they existed in dialogue with each other. All right. So the cradle of civilization is the Middle East. Why? Because of the Fertile Crescent. Okay? So Sumeria, Sumer, is where we consider the cradle of civilization. Because as I mentioned to you, it is the center of all global trade. It's where all civilizations meet. But as you can also see, it's also extremely fertile. Okay? So this has historically been the wealthiest part of the world. Strategically, it's the most important part of the world, and it's still true even today. Okay? That's why you have all these wars in the Middle East. That's why America is so supportive of Israel. Okay, so as I mentioned to you, what will happen is that because of trade, Uruk will become a large city. And then as the city becomes larger and larger, it will establish colonies elsewhere as well. And these will become the major city-states of Mesopotamia. And for thousands of years, they will fight each other until Sargon of Akkad unifies this region, okay? Sumer is impressive. They're known for their canals. They're known for their irrigation. And again, scholars are sort of mesmerized by how they're able to do this. But one thing that you learn in this class is that when humans come together for religious purposes, they're capable of doing amazing stuff. These are ziggurats, they're temples. Okay? And these ziggurats were the center of their civilization. Remember that all cities start off with a temple that then builds out outwards, okay? And these ziggurats are important because they are literally considered the home of their gods. And these places are sacred. So only priests are allowed to go inside it. People can deliver gifts to the gods through the priests. But the people themselves are not allowed to interact with the priests. And that's how the priests are able to keep control over the cities, okay? And the priests themselves are considered servants of the gods. This is cuneiform, okay? This is cuneiform, which is the first writing system ever invented. What's interesting about this is how they did this. So what they did was this. They just took clay from the riverbeds, okay? And then before it hardens, you just take a reed and you write down some marks in the clay. And then what you do is this. You just put it out in the sun and then it hardens, right? And it's there forever. That's why we still have them today, because rock does not decay, okay? And that's why we know more about Sumeria than we know about other places. For most of agricultural history, we celebrate the mother goddess, okay? But then, as I mentioned, over time, as society becomes larger and larger, the men start to take control. And so they inverted the mythology of the mother goddess. Now, the sky god, who is Marduk here, kills the mother goddess to create the world. Okay? A process of inversion. So, to understand this process, we will read the most famous epic from Mesopotamia called the Enuma Elish. Enuma Elish means from up high. So it's the Bible, basically. It's like what God told us. And this is a story of the creation of the world. Okay, so what's really important to understand is that all the stories are written down in stone, okay? And again, guys, they didn't have to do this because everyone was able to memorize the story line for line. And that's what we did historically. So why did they write this in stone? For propaganda purposes, right? It's the same as in today's world, you go see a film. When you see a film, you're mesmerized, you're hypnotized by the beauty of it. And you must think that this film must be the God speaking themselves. Okay, you don't think about, okay, how did they put this together? Your mind doesn't think like that. Your mind's like, oh my God, this is an image before me, therefore it must be true. Okay, and that's why they wrote stuff down for propaganda purposes. Now, what's interesting is that there's different writing systems around the world. So in Mesopotamia, they had these K tablets, right? But in Egypt, as you may know, they have papyrus. Okay, papyrus are these plants. They take out the plants and then put them together in the sun. Okay, and then they become like these scrolls that you can write on. And China, of course, had the paper. So what's interesting is that when the need arises for writing, we always find of like creative ways to express ourselves in writing. Okay? Papyrus scrolls don't really last that long. That's why we know less about Egypt than we know about Mesopotamia. All right, so the Amenemhat letter was written on K tablets. So let's go over the story, the Amenemhat letter. So in the beginning, there are two major gods, Apsu and Tiamat. Apsu means fresh water. Tiamat means salt water. Okay, fresh water, of course, is the river. Salt water is the ocean. Okay, when they come together, they create all possible life, including their children, the new gods. Tiamat and Apsu create these new gods, but they're children, so they're really loud. And Apsu is like, you know what? These children are really annoying. I want to kill them. Tiamat overhears this, and Tiamat tells her children who rebel and kill Apsu. But then Tiamat's like, you know what? They killed my husband. So now she's pissed, okay? So she decides she's going to go kill her children too. She has a general, and there is this huge army, and they start to attack their children. These children are thrown aback by Tiamat. So they elect a new champion called Marduk, the thunder god, the sky god, to lead them into battle against Tiamat. And in the final battle, Marduk, who's also called Bel, he kills Tiamat, okay? Now what happens afterwards is really interesting, because after he kills Tiamat, the mother goddess, he takes her body, and then from her body, he builds the entire world. He builds both the sky and the planet Earth, okay? So let's read some lines. Bel rested, serving the corpse, in order to divide the lump by a clever scheme. He split her into two like a dried fish, okay? So he literally cut her like a fish. One half of her he set up and stretched out as the heavens. He built the sky from her body. He stretched the skin and appointed a watch with the instruction not to let her waters escape. He crossed over the heavens, surveyed the celestial parts, and adjusted them to match the Apsu, Nemunet's abode. So Apsu was the husband who was killed. Bel measured the shape of the Apsu and set up Esra, a replica of Eskela, in Eskela, Esra, which he had built, and the heavens he settled in the shrines Anu, Enlil, and El. Okay? So what's important to understand is this. He's doing this to the mother goddess. Okay, so not only is Marduk proclaiming a new order, but he's also proclaiming new values of struggle, exploitation, toil, right? Before, the mother goddess was a religion of balance and harmony. Don't destroy things. Worship the animals as they're your friends. If you kill them, make sacrifices to them. And now this new religion is, no, destroy the world and make it yours, okay? So this is a civilization that practiced irrigation, right? Because irrigation really is about controlling the earth. All right, let's continue. All right, so what happens now is that after Marduk creates the world, he has to establish a bureaucratic order, okay? An order, a hierarchical order. So he says, he fashioned heavenly stations for the great god and set up constellations, the patterns of the stars. He appointed the year, marked up divisions, and set up three stars each for the 12 months. Okay? So he's basically building a calendar. The idea here is that all these were bureaucratic inventions in Sumeria in order to better govern the people, right? What this myth is doing, the Amenemhat letter is doing, is proclaiming that the bureaucratic world is divinely ordained. Okay? This didn't come from the priests, it came from the gods. The priests are just the messengers. All right, let's continue. All right, so now that Marduk has built this world, he's like, you know what? I'm tired and I want a place to rest. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to build a house, which is my temple, and then I'm going to make slaves in order to serve me. And these slaves are called humans, okay? That's why we were invented, to serve the gods. Before we understood that the gods served us, helped us. or loved us. And now we must become slaves to the gods. Beneath the celestial parts, whose floor I made firm, I will build a house to be my luxurious abode. Within I will establish a shrine, I will found my chamber and establish my kingship. Okay? All right, so now he's going to turn humans into slaves. He conceived the desire to accomplish clever things. He opened his mouth, addressing Eel. He counsels that which he had pondered in his heart. I will bring together blood to form bone. I will bring into being Lula, whose name shall be man. Okay? All right. And the gods, by the way, are called the Anunnaki, okay? That's why there are conspiracy theorists on the internet who say that we were invented by the Anunnaki. All right. So what Marduk does is that he takes his enemy, Tingu, and then he kills him, and then from his blood, he will create mankind. Okay? They bound him, holding him before Ael. They inflicted the penalty on him and severed his blood vessels. From his blood, he created mankind, on whom he imposed the service of the gods and set the gods free. Okay? Now, what's really interesting for us to remember is that throughout this poem, Marduk has different names, Bel, Eel, okay? And the reason why is that what happens in these epics is they take different traditions and they combine together into one composite story, okay? All right. After the wise Eel had created mankind and had imposed the service of the gods upon them, that task is beyond comprehension, for Nimrodah performed the creation with the skill of Marduk. King Marduk divided the gods, or the Anunnaki, okay, the gods, into upper and lower groups. He assigned 300 in the heavens to guard the decrees of Anu and appointed them as a guard. Okay? So now he's going to create this hierarchy. So, yes, all humans are slaves, but there are some humans who are better slaves than other humans, okay? And that's what explains the hierarchy. So as you can see, the Enumerated Ledge, it was written in order to justify the existing power structure. And honestly, this is a concept that's still true today, right? Why do we have schools? Why do we have media? Why do we have entertainment? It's to justify the existing power structure and social order, okay? All right. Now we get towards the end, and this is to establish that Babylon is the divine city. If it's divine, it means you can't leave it. You all want to be here, even though being in Babylon means you're enslavement, okay? Let us make a shrine of great renown. Your chamber will be our resting place wherein we may repose. Let us erect a shrine to house a pedestal where we may repose when we finish the work. When Marduk heard this, he beamed as brightly as the light of day. Build Babylon, the task you have sought. Let bricks for it be molded and raise the shrine. The Anunnaki wield the pick. For 1 year, they made the needed bricks. Okay? So Babylon, the capital, is a city made by the gods for the gods. And then humans are there to serve the gods. Okay, so this is the divine order. This is the mandate of heaven. Okay, and as you will see, this is not just true for Mesopotamia, for Babylon, but also true for all major civilizations, including Egypt. Okay, so this is a tapestry from Egypt. As you can see, the gods are in control. The gods are the puppet masters. And the kings are just being controlled by the gods, and then humans just do what the gods demand of them, okay? This is just the natural order. This is the mandate of heaven. This is the way that it should be. Okay, now let's talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh. So there are two major literary achievements of Mesopotamia. The first is the Enumerated Ledge. The second is something called the Epic of Gilgamesh. As you can see, Gilgamesh, he is a giant human. He's a king. He's considered the first king of Uruk, okay? And he's so big that a lion is his pet. Okay. What happens is that Gilgamesh is a king, but he's a tyrant. So he takes the men to war and he sleeps with all the women. So the people cry to the gods for relief from Gilgamesh. So the gods create Enkidu from clay. Okay, and this is very similar to the story of Adam in the Bible. And Enkidu is like an animal. But then Gilgamesh sends a prostitute to seduce him and then becomes civilized, okay? And now Enkidu and Gilgamesh fight. And when they fight, they realize that they can't beat each other. So they decide to become best friends. They're best friends now, and they embark on all these adventures together. They go kill these divine beings. They go kill the protector of the forest. They kill a divine bull. The gods are now kind of pissed at them because they're disrupting the natural order, okay? So the gods have a meeting. They decide that one of them must die. So they kill Enkidu. When Enkidu dies, Gilgamesh is heartbroken. And he's scared because he's afraid that he will die as well. So he sets on a quest for immortality. Okay? He goes and tries to figure out how to live forever. He ultimately fails. Okay? And it ends with Gilgamesh returning home and he sees happiness in the walled cities. In his people being happy. Okay? So the moral of the story is that immortality is not about living forever. Immortality is about doing great things for your people so that you'll be remembered forever, celebrate forever. So the irony is that even though Gilgamesh failed in his quest, he ultimately succeeded in his mission because we have his epic, and so we're able to celebrate him even today. Okay, so it's a story that is being told. The question now is, why is this story being told? And one theory is that this is a concept of kingship. Being a king means not doing whatever you want. Being a king means to serve the people so that people will celebrate you and remember you forever and immortalize you in writing. Okay? That's a theory. All right. But ultimately, Gilgamesh is a bureaucratic creation. And I'm going to explain to you how this creation works. Through this creation process, we can understand how human society develops over time. So in the beginning, what happens is that each region has local legends, okay? And these local heroes are celebrated through stories. So stories of demigods like Hercules, right? And the epic heroism. They have these stories because each region has a local king. And this local king says, well, I'm a descendant of Hercules, and therefore I should rule over you, okay? And what will happen is that these stories become a test for the king. If Hercules can fight a lion, then you are his ancestor, descendant, right? You are his descendant, therefore you should go fight a lion, okay? And that's how you justify your kingship, through these acts of heroism that's relayed to you in stories, okay? That's the first step. Second step is what happens is that as these different areas become consolidated into a much larger area, these stories themselves become consolidated. So Gilgamesh was basically different heroes. One king comes to dominate a region. Then what happens afterwards is that as the region becomes larger and larger, you need a bureaucracy. So bureaucratic priests come into power, they add in morality and message and control the people and the king. Okay, the major message is the king must serve the people, and then the priests control the king. But what will happen is that these different bureaucratic factions will fight each other, and they will have different versions of the story, okay? So bureaucratic priests take power, the morality and messaging changes, okay? As different bureaucratic priests take power, okay? The king must learn humility. So this is a hard thing to understand, but it's really important for us to understand, otherwise you cannot understand the Bible and other literary creations. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna give you an example to help you better understand this process of storytelling. All right. So let's imagine three universities, Ohio State University, Connecticut, and Middlebury. And they all have their own local legends, okay? So in these places, something happened that captured the imagination of all the students. So maybe at Ohio State University, Michael James gets drunk the night before examination, and he still manages to pass it. And the students are like, that's a great story, okay? But what happens over time is that because it's just a great story, as the story is told more and more, it becomes exaggerated. Why? Because it becomes exaggerated, it's much more interesting, it's become much more memorable, okay? And over time, people add color to it to make it even more memorable. If you don't do that, the story becomes forgotten, okay? So the only way to keep a story alive is by constantly exaggerating it and bringing color to it. So let's see what happens. Over time, the story becomes Michael James gets drunk before every examination and he scores 100, okay? That's an exaggeration. And then, over time, naturally, through the oral tradition, the story becomes even more exaggerated. Michael James bet his professor that he could get 100 on the exam while drunk. After James finished the exam, he vomited on the professor. He threw up on the professor. The professor could not do anything because James had got 100 on the exam. Okay? All right? So human beings just do this naturally. If something happens, they think it's interesting, then it becomes a legend, becomes a story, okay? And this happens everywhere. So Connecticut College, a football player scores a winning touchdown, okay? And then it becomes exaggerated. The guy scores touchdown every game, and then even more exaggerated, the guy hits a home run to help his team win the championship, and then later that day, he scores a touchdown to win another, okay? So it becomes more exaggerated. And then let's look at the last one. At Middlebury College, Pat Jack drives to Canada to take a piss, okay? He just does that for no reason. Becomes more exaggerated. He goes to a new city every day to take a piss, okay? And then it becomes even more exaggerated. And now you add color and detail to it. Pat Jack drove to Canada and accidentally pissed on a sleeping bear, okay? He ran up a tree without his pants and forest rangers had to come rescue him. Okay? All right? So this is what happens naturally. The story becomes funnier. The story becomes more colorful, more detailed, more exaggerated, so that we're able to remember it, okay? And then over time, what happens is that these stories become consolidated, combined together to form a new story, okay? Harvard's most legendary student was Pitbull James. He once wrote an exam that no professor could pass. He once hit a home run with one arm. He once pissed on a sleeping bear just so he could knock down the bear with one punch, okay? So it becomes even more exaggerated, it becomes consolidated. Just as the Epic of Gilgamesh, okay? But then what happens is the bureaucrats take over. Okay, the people in charge take over and they have to change the story in order to better control people. And there are different versions of this process. So let's look at three. All right, you add just one line and you change the story, right? In the first version, when he became a billionaire, he gave it all to Harvard. Okay? So obviously Harvard wrote this story to say, you know what, we don't care what you do as you give us money, okay? That's the first version. Second version is, when he wrote, he found his true love, he settled down in the woods to write full time. Okay? So this is signaling the primacy of writers over athletes, okay? The smart over the brave. And the third is, the bear ate him, okay? So he punches the bear and the bear decides to eat him, which is like, don't be a stupid athlete. Okay? And so when you add these actually lines, you make the story less interesting, less colorful. But you do so in order to better control how people think. And this is a process that we see throughout human history. So think of these classics, of these Chinese classics, right? Sang Guan Yan Yi, Romance of the Three Kingdoms. COG, right? Journey to the West. Shui Hu Zhuan, right? Bandits of the Water Margin. If you read them, they're not that interesting. But before, you can imagine that they were interesting. But the bureaucrats took them and changed them into boring stories that they can now teach school children to brainwash them. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, so that's a process of civilization. All right, so another example is Hesiod's Theogony. And he's talking about Greek mythology, okay? Greek religion. So the process goes like this. At first, Gaia, who's like the mother goddess, and Chaos, they give birth to the gods. Gaia marries one of these gods, Uranus, okay? And they give birth together to 12 titans. But Uranus doesn't really like children, so he beats up his children. So these children, with help from the mother, decides to rebel against Uranus. The youngest son, Cronus, kills Uranus. Okay? Then Uranus marries Rhea, and now Cronus is king, but he's afraid that his children will eventually rebel against him, just like he rebelled against his father. Therefore, he eats all his children. Rhea, the mother, is upset about this, so she decides, I'm going to give birth to Zeus in secret. So she runs off to an island, and she gives birth to him in secret, and he leaves Zeus there to grow up, okay? Eventually, he grows up, and then he goes back to Cronus. He becomes cupbearer to Cronus, and then poisons him, okay? And that's how Zeus becomes the ultimate king. What's really interesting for our purposes is that this myth influences the origin story of major historical figures, okay? So if you look at these major historical figures, you will find that it's a very similar story.
So Sargon of Akkad, who founded the Akkadian Empire, Romulus and Remus, who founded Rome, King David, who founded Israel, and Genghis Khan of the Mongols, okay? They all share this similar origin story. So where do we get this origin story from? Okay, so going back, we're seeing three layers, right? So the first layer is the original layer, which is the animistic layer, okay? So different gods come together and they create humans. The second layer is when Cronus rebels against Uranus and establishes the kingship, okay? Right? The third layer is this. The third layer is the most interesting. Usually when you're king, you need a general. And what often happens is that the king likes to hire a foreign mercenary to be a general. Why? Because first of all, he's of low birth, right? Therefore, no legitimacy. Second, he's a foreigner, and therefore he doesn't have any political factions behind him. But often what happens is that this foreign mercenary is so talented that he's able to build a political faction to overthrow the king and become king himself because he's really talented. This is true for Genghis Khan. This is true for King David of Israel. This is true for Sargon of Akkad, okay? So there are lots of historical figures like that. Even in Chinese history, you have quite a few historical figures like this as well. So the founder of the Song Dynasty was this sort of person. The problem, though, is that once he becomes king, he has a legitimacy problem. He's of low birth. He's a foreigner, right? So what do? You create a myth of Zeus, right? That Zeus himself was of low birth and a foreigner, but not really because he's a secret son of the king, okay? And that's why you have these stories. To legitimize the king. All right. So again, this follows the dynastic cycle, okay? So in the beginning, the high priestess, who represents the mother goddess, she has a consort. And so they establish a hereditary elite. But this hereditary elite makes people unhappy with the system. So then one prince or one of the sons decides, you know what, I'm going to form my own political faction. I'm going to become a warlord. I'm going to overthrow the queen and the king, okay? And so he slays the consort and marries the high priestess, okay? Which is following the pattern of the mythology, right? Then what happens is that after the warlord dies, his son relies on a mercenary as general. The mercenary is often a foreigner and of low birth. Mercenary slays the warlord and makes himself king, okay? Okay? Does that make sense? This is a pattern that we see over and over in history. And this explains why the myths are constructed the way they are. Okay, so another way, a metaphor that we can use is think of myths and stories as like house renovation, okay? So when you renovate a house, you're adding different layers to it. Okay, that's literally what's happening. Okay, so we will look at one last story to show you how this writing process works. Remember, they meant writing in order to basically gaslight the people. So even though Sumeria, Mesopotamia, is developing really quickly, as you can see from this map, it's still a very diverse place, okay? They have different forms of industry and economy. So maybe in the green, you have agriculture, but in the red, it's pastoral, meaning you're raising animals, sheep, goats, you're going all over the place, okay? So there are two different types of agriculture. The first form is you are sedentary. You just stay in one place and you grow your food. You grow your crops. You grow your plants. The second is pastoral, where you're going around and you are feeding your sheep and your goats, okay? If you're a king, or if you're a priest, if you're a bureaucrat, do you prefer agricultural people or pastoral people? Obviously agriculture. Why? Because it's easier to control them, okay? So what they do now is they're going to create these mythologies to convince people to give up the free, happy lifestyle of a pastoralist and become an enslaved farmer, okay? All right? And the question is how? Well, this is how. This is called the debate between the sheep and the grain, okay? So the sheep and the grain have this debate and they appear before the gods for judgment. The sheep says, I'm the better one. The grain says, no, I'm the better one. Okay, so they have this debate. The sheep says this. And can the gods make me descend from the holy place, my most precious place? All the yarns about Otu, the splendor of kingship, belong to me. Second, king of the mountain embosses the king's emblems and puts his implements in order. He twists a giant rope against the great peaks of the rebel land, he the sling, the quiver, and the long bows. The watch over the elite troops is mine. Sustenance of the workers in the field is mine. The water skin of cool water and the sandals are mine. Sweet oil, the fragrance of the gods, mixed oil, pressed oil, aromatic oil, cedar oil for offerings are mine. Okay? So I'm the sheep. Look how great I am. Okay? I provide clothing for people. I provide sandals. I have oil, which makes people more fragrant. I also provide food for your soldiers. So I'm great. In the gown, my cloth of white wool, the king rejoices on his throne. My clothing is worn by the king himself. Isn't that proof that I'm the greatest? My body glistens on the flesh of the great gods. After purification priest, the incarnation priest, and the bath priest have dressed themselves in me for my holy lustration. I walk with them to my holy meal. Okay? So the priest, when they make sacrifices, they sacrifice the sheep. The priests are not going to sacrifice grain, they're going to sacrifice sheep, okay? But your hero, plowshare binding, and sharps are tools that can be utterly destroyed. What can you put against me? And answer me what you can reply, okay? So that's the argument from the sheep. The grain says, when the bear dough has been carefully prepared in the oven and the mash ended, tended in the oven, Nikasha mixes them for me while your big bully goats and rams are dispatched for my banquet. On the thick legs, they are made to stand separate from my produce. Your shepherd on the high plain eyes my produce endlessly. When I am standing in a furrow in the field, my farmer chases away your herdsmen with his cudgel. Even when they look out for you from the open country to the hidden places, your fears are not removed from you. Fang snakes and bandits, the creatures of the desert, want your life on the high plain. Every night your count is made and your tally stick put into ground so your herdsmen can tell people how many eels there are and how many young lambs and how many goats and how many young kids. When gentle winds blow through the city and strong winds scatter, they build a milking pen for you. But when gentle winds blow through the city and strong winds scatter, I stand up as an equal to Issachar. I am grain, I am born for the warrior. I do not give up the churn, the vat on legs, the adornments of shepherding. Make up your properties. What can you put against me? Answer me what you can reply, okay? Well, what grain says is, first of all, you don't need to protect me. I can protect myself. There are no animals that want to eat me. Okay, and I'm bountiful, okay, so I'm independent. You do less work, you get more of me. Okay, that's the argument. And of course, the gods say that grain is better. Even though people who raise sheep and goats, they're stronger, they're more free, they're more independent. But kings don't want that. So they create these stories, these mythologies, in order to brainwash people out of their freedom, out of their independence. Okay, and that's why we have writing. That's why they invented writing. Okay? Does that make sense to you guys?
Yes.
All right. Any questions?
So my first question is, like, earlier you mentioned that there are three ancient civilizations that are very close to each other, like Egyptian and...
That's right. So they... Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my question is, like... Are there any connections between their distance and how they made all of this myth and their methodologies of creating the gods?
Okay, that's a really good question. It's almost impossible to answer how much they influence each other, okay? Because even if they were not in contact with each other, they would still come up with the myths that they had come up with in order to justify their hierarchy. Okay, does that make sense? So myth-making is just a natural part of the human process. So do they share these stories together? Probably, okay? But what's important to understand is that these elites are also interested in differentiation. So if I'm in Egypt, I need to prove to my people that I'm superior to the people in Mesopotamia and in this valley civilization, and that's why I create the pyramids, right? Okay, if I'm in Mesopotamia, I need to prove that I'm superior. That's why I create the Ziggurats and the Epic of Gilgamesh. All right, so the actual process, it's hard to say. Okay, so another way of thinking of this is, how much are you influenced by American popular culture? Probably a lot, but how much? Okay. Also, you whatever influence that you have, you still also refract it for your own personal needs as well. Okay, so that's a great question. And, you know, scholars spend a long time, decades, trying to figure out what the actual influence of each culture is on the other culture. And from my perspective, it's not important. We just have to assume that there is influence, that these cultures are in contact with each other. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what they come up with has to be unique to their own culture. They want to prove that their culture is superior, and they want to, and they have to address local needs as well. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And I have another question. Is that I don't know how familiar you are with the Chinese culture, but in our Chinese culture, there is a god who created the earth. Like his name is Pangu. Mm-hmm. Like there is this mythology of how Pangu creates the earth. And so my question is, like, you can notice that in the Chinese culture, Pangu is a male, and he is the one who sacrificed himself to in order to create the earth. And in other myths, like in Egyptians, that the creator is this female character. So in your opinion, like, do you think there is, like, what is the, why is this different between?
Okay, yeah. So it's hard for us to say what the original myth was. Okay, but the process is this: in the very beginning, all gods should be asexual. Okay, so they are almost, they're either non-sexual, like it's not male or female, or they are both male and female. Okay, because in all traditions, the god has to be a balance of forces, right? So the male force and the female force. That's why we have yin and yang. But over time, what will happen is that they will change certain characteristics to reflect better the hierarchy. So maybe in the beginning, when females were in charge, Pangu was a female character. But over time, they'll change it to a male character. All right? It's almost impossible for us to go back and rebuild or reimagine what it was like originally. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Any more questions, guys? Okay. Great. So I hope this makes sense. And next class, what we're going to do is we will talk about the steppes people. Okay? The people in the steppes. This is civilization, so people who do agriculture. But remember that throughout most of human history, the major conquerors were people from the steppes, okay? So Genghis Khan came from the steppes. So we'll be discussing them next class, okay? All right, thank you.